You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, 1,000 years before the time of Christ, King Solomon wrote this in the book of Ecclesiastes. He says, "Better to spend your time at funerals than at parties. After all, everyone dies, so the living should take this to heart." He had a rough couple of decades at the end of his life. But there's some real wisdom in what he's saying. And, you know, it's interesting because for the early part of my life, I was relatively free from funerals. I really wasn't touched much by the death of people who were close to me. Not nearly as much as many of you have experienced that. But about 10 years ago, I went through a couple of year period where I spent more time at funerals than I had at the entire swath of my life up until that point. You know, at first it was several people passed away who were very old, you know, in their 80s and 90s, and death is never fine, but you sort of expect it when people get to a certain age. But then people started dying in my life that were far too young to die. It was very sudden. A guy, good friend of mine who was 21, he drowned tragically at an event where a number of us were present. A friend of mine, his sister was 17. She went to bed one night, just didn't wake up the next morning. There was a suicide in there. There was a friend of mine, her dad died of cancer. It was 4 weeks between when they found the cancer and when they had the funeral. Another friend of mine, his mom died of cancer, far younger than anyone expected her to pass away. And you know, at the time, I read some different things about grief. I was feeling things, I didn't know what to make of those. I was having thoughts, I didn't know what to make of those, I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't really know how to help the people in my life that were going through the same grief. There's some things I wish I would have known. At the time, I did some reading. I read some memoirs of people that had faced grief, the death of spouses. I'll share some of that tonight. I also studied through and taught this passage and feel like God really spoke to me, ministered to me through that. And so I hope that I can pass some of that along to you guys here tonight as well as we look at Jesus is gonna go to a funeral. He's gonna spend time at a funeral here and we're gonna see what does Jesus do in John chapter 11. Well, we read that a man named Lazarus was sick and he lived in Bethany with his sisters, Mary and Martha. We can read about Mary and Martha in the book of Luke. We'll read a story about Mary in the very next chapter. But this was a brother and two sisters. They lived together. Jesus would stay with them somewhat frequently, it seems. And it says in verse 3, the two sisters sent a message to Jesus. And so, you know, much like many funerals, they begin with a message that says something like this: "Lord, your dear friend is very sick." Maybe you guys, maybe there's an incident in your mind, a funeral that you went to, and you can remember the message that you got. Was it a text message? Call me as soon as you can. Was it a phone call from someone that never calls? Was it someone showing up on your doorstep and you could tell from the look on their face that something was wrong? Jesus got a message: "Lord, your dear friend is very sick." And this message can come suddenly and things can move so quickly, so much quicker than we would ever expect. The two sisters sent a message to Jesus: "Lord, your dear friend is very sick." And so you've got to understand what it's like to send a message like this and what it's like to receive a message like this. But when Jesus heard about it, he said, "Lazarus's sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this." And so Jesus makes a promise, and this is probably the message he gave to the messenger. You know, they sent a messenger. You know, you couldn't just send a letter through the postal service. You'd send a messenger. "Lord, your dear friend is very sick." And oftentimes there's an expectation that you send a return message. And so this was apparently the return message that he sent: "The sickness will not end in death. It happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory through this." And so he sends the message back. Sounds like good news, right? And it says, although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. Now, this is actually a pretty strange translation. The word "although" is not there in the original text. What it actually says is what the NASB translates it: "Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was." So because he loved them, it's not well, he loved them, but he still had to stay where he was for two more days. No, because he loved them so much, he stays right where he is for the next 2 days. He doesn't go running. You know, Jesus was a guy that healed many sick people. They're assuming the implied request in this message is, come here quickly so you can heal our brother whom you love before he dies. And Jesus, because he loved them so much, does absolutely nothing for the next 2 days. Stays right where he is. How strange is that? 2 days longer. You know, when Jesus gets to Bethany, what we're gonna find, Lazarus is dead. And in fact, he'd already been in the grave for 4 days. So regardless of where he was, even if he had left right away, Lazarus would have already been dead for 2 days. You can see that. You can get out a calendar, do the math. If he had left right away, Lazarus would have been dead for 2 days by the time he got there, okay? So either way, Lazarus, he's probably died by the time the messengers even reached Jesus, much less by the time the messenger returns to Mary and Martha. And the messenger returns and Lazarus is dead. And they said, what did Jesus say? And he says, this won't end in death. That actually he'll be glorified through this. That's a mixed message right there. That's a confusing message to receive in the midst of planning a funeral and putting your brother in the grave. Lazarus had already been in the grave for 4 days. Why did he do this? Well, if you read ancient sources, you read that Jews believed that the soul hovered over the body for 3 days. You know, they would have experiences where they thought someone was dead, but they didn't have the modern medical technology to manage all the vital signs. And so there were times where they would be quickly putting the person in the coffin and taking them to the tomb, and then they'd hear a little tap, tap, tap on the inside of the coffin. And they'd be like, whoa, he's still alive. And so, you know, by the third day, okay, we have like refrigeration techniques and embalming techniques to make dead people look alive for a little bit longer. They didn't have that. By the third day, that body was really starting to rot, really starting to smell. And they were certain that by the third day, the body had rotted to the point where the soul was not gonna re-enter the body. And so they knew that they were dead. If Jesus had gone immediately, he's gonna raise Lazarus from the dead, okay? That's the spoiler alert in this story here. But it's still a great story, okay? If he goes back and raises Lazarus when he's only been dead for 2 days, they're like, oh, well, I guess he would have probably come back to life anyway. You ever had that where you pray for something that happens? You're like, oh, I guess it was gonna happen anyway. I didn't need to pray for that at all. No, he's waiting until everyone knew that Lazarus was truly dead because he wanted them to know that he doesn't raise people who are just mostly dead. He doesn't just, you know, get the paddles out and shock people, okay? He gets people who are completely and totally dead and starting to rot, and then he brings them back to life. Because he knew that one day, Mary and Martha, whom he loved, would be facing their own death, and they would need to have answers in the face of death. And Jesus knew that the people who would read the Gospel of John in that day and the people who would witness this miracle would be facing their own death one day, and they needed to know where to turn in the face of true death. And Jesus could see, long before he stood by the grave of Lazarus, he could see down through the millennia to right here tonight. And he knew that there would be people here facing death, facing news about death. If not now, someday, probably very soon. And he wants you to know that he is the God who can raise those who are truly dead. And you know, just to get a sense, what happens to a body on day four when it's not refrigerated, when it's not embalmed? First of all, let me just give you a sense for how impossible this task would have been to raise a body that had been dead for 4 days. You know, your digestive tract has so many bacteria and enzymes in there to break down the food. But when you die, they don't stay put where they're supposed to be. They release into the body and they start digesting you. Not only that, but the 36 or so trillion cells in your body, you know, within a few hours of death, the membranes in those cells begin to break down and enzymes within those cells are released into the surrounding area. And they begin to break down the different body parts, the different organic tissue in that region. You have 60,000 miles of arteries and veins and capillaries in your body. Those collapse when the heart is not pumping blood through those tubes. And the tubes begin to break down, they deflate. The eyes deflate, the eye pressure drops to zero. The brain liquefies, It's one of the earlier organs to liquefy because it doesn't really have, it has no bones or anything in it. And so the brain turns into a kind of a liquidy goo by day four, well before day four. The heart dissolves, again, consumed by enzymes. It's not gonna beat anymore. You have over 500,000 miles of neural pathways in your body. Those are all gone. Again, consumed by enzymes. Your 36 trillion cells have mostly dissolved by now. They're in various states of decomposition. Not to mention the gas buildup from all of the rotting, the bloating in the body. Sometimes actually holes will kind of blow out in the body or body parts like the eyes will shoot out because of the pressure buildup from the gas. There are fluids, the fat in your body is liquefying. The maggots, okay, they say that bugs find the body within 10 minutes of death in its normal, just room temperature state. They begin laying eggs and the maggots hatch and they speed up. They accelerate the decomposition process. The skin turns a pale color at first, bruising in the lower parts, and then it's a greenish color by day four, all right? This was not a perfect looking body sitting on the table that Jesus shocks back to life. This was a rotten, decomposing, bloated corpse by day four. This is why the Jews, they put some spices in there, some perfumes, they wrapped it, and then they tried to get that thing in the ground as soon as possible. Lazarus had been in the grave for 4 days. He was dead. And Jesus is going to show that he raises those who are truly dead. Finally, he says to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. That's the area around Jerusalem. His disciples objected, Rabbi, only a few days ago, the people in Judea were trying to stone you. Are you going there again? Remember in chapter 8 when they picked up stones to stone him? Remember in chapter 10 when they picked up stones to stone him? They're like, why are you going to go back to Jerusalem? You're a wanted man there. Jesus replied, there are 12 hours of daylight every day. During the day, people can walk safely. They can see because they have the light of this world. The sun is shining. But at night, there's danger of stumbling because they have no light. Yeah, back then you worked while there was daylight. And then when the day was over, your work was done. And Jesus is saying, my day has a little bit longer. He knows that his night will not come until the cross, a month or two from this point. You know, we're moving into the final weeks of Jesus's life. And he says, I don't have to worry about dying if we go back to Judea because I know I'm not gonna die until the cross. He says, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but now I will go and wake him up. Lord, if he's sleeping, he'll get better. Isn't that good? They thought Jesus meant Lazarus was simply sleeping, but Jesus meant Lazarus had died. He's trying to say it in a nice way. So he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And for your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there, for now you will really believe. Not that he's glad Lazarus is dead, but he says, I'm glad I wasn't there because you guys, you're gonna see something. See something incredible. You're gonna see something that's gonna happen when I go back and you are going to truly believe. Remember the Gospel of John is all about belief in Jesus, trusting in Jesus. He says, come, let's go see him. And then Thomas, nicknamed the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let's go to and die with Jesus. Thomas doesn't look awesome in the Gospels. Although, you know, he's willing to go die with Jesus. I guess that's pretty good, right? Well, Jesus arrived at Bethany and he was told Lazarus had already been in his grave for 4 days. Bethany was only a few miles down the road from Jerusalem. You have Jerusalem, east of Jerusalem, you have the Mount of Olives. And then just on the east side of the Mount of Olives, you have the little city of Bethany. Jesus would stay there quite frequently. Many of the people had come to console Mary and Martha in their loss. And so people had actually traveled from Jerusalem to Bethany. Jewish funerals. There was a 7-day period of intense grief. And during this time, this was a time where the Mishnah says that even poor families were required to hire 2 flautists and 1 professional wailing woman as part of the funeral festivities. And these were to, you know, they weren't like our funerals today. Everybody's like, oh, thank you for coming. There's heavy music playing. People are very stoic. Maybe they're dabbing their eyes with Kleenex. You know, back then it was very much like people expressing their grief and wailing and weeping. And this was a time for people to be together. And people were coming, they were consoling Mary and Martha in their loss. So they're about halfway through the most intense time of the grieving. The total grieving period was 30 days. But the first week was a very intense week. When Martha got word that Jesus was coming, she goes out to meet him. She actually goes and meets him outside of Bethany. And so here we have the sister Martha. This is Martha, the strong Martha, the woman with the spiritual gift of functioning. She's able to set aside the grief. She's able to set aside the funeral preparations, which I'm sure she was running. And she goes out and she meets Jesus outside of the city. But Mary stayed in the house. Mary, the tender soul. We find her sitting at Jesus's feet in Luke chapter 10. Mary stayed in the house with the rest of the guests. And when Martha reached Jesus, she said, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. If only you'd been here, my brother would not have died." And so you can see the grief here in Martha. You can see the questioning. You know, there's a lot of questions when we face death. You know, one question that you hear a lot in the face of death is, if only, what ifs? There's a lot of what ifs in the face of death. If only I, you know, could I have prevented this? If only I had seen the signs, if only I had spoken a word of warning, if only I had driven that night and not him or her. Could others have prevented this? If only that person had not been driving drunk. If only this hadn't happened, if only that hadn't happened. Were there signs? Should I have seen them? Should I have noticed how this person was feeling? Should I have noticed the direction that they were heading? Did I make the most of my time with this person? If only they had done something differently. If only they had taken better care of themselves. If only they had not been so foolish. There's a lot of anger, a lot of what ifs, a lot of doubts in the face of death. And this just mixes in this very confusing emotional cocktail of anger and regret and guilt and numbness, sometimes all on the same day, sometimes all at the same time. And if you've been through death, you know what this feels like. You know what this is. I read a couple of memoirs, like I said, at the time where I was going through this in my life. And one was by a woman named Joan Didion called The Year of Magical Thinking. And this is her memoirs from the year after her husband died. What happened was she sat down to eat dinner on New Year's Eve with her husband and he drops dead of a heart attack just suddenly. And so she calls it The Year of Magical Thinking because throughout this year, she's like, I can't get rid of his shoes because he's gonna need them when he comes back. I can't do this because, you know, he'll need that when he returns. And she said, my thinking, it was magical thinking. I was thinking, if I can just believe that he's coming back, then he will come back. And if I stop believing, then he won't come back anymore. And so she was kind of holding him alive in her mind. And she discusses this confusion in the face of death. She says, life changes fast, life changes in an instant. You sit down to dinner and life as you know it ends. And that's a repeated refrain throughout this book. You sit down to dinner and life as you know it ends. She says, it was in fact the ordinary nature of everything preceding the event that preceded me from truly believing it had happened. Yeah, the first stage of death is denial. You're in such shock. You're like, that can't be the case. That can't be right. People who've recently lost someone have a certain look, recognizable maybe only to those who have seen that look on their own faces. She says, you want to be around people who understand grief, who understand death, who understand what you're going through. The look is one of extreme vulnerability, nakedness, openness. Yeah, part of the problem is we were never meant to die. God created us to live forever. In relationship with him. It's when we turned away from God, that's what introduced death and evil into this world. And so when death comes up, we just don't have a file to put it in. There's no drawer to put this thing in. And so people grieve in all kinds of different ways, and they're all lacking something because it's a terrible experience we were not meant to go through. C.S. Lewis writes this memoir after the death of his wife. In fact, this originally was just his journals as he worked through his own grief. And what happened was a friend of his read the journals and they said, this is really good. I think if you publish this, I think this would be helpful to people. So he published it. One, he changed his wife's name to H, which she went by Joy, but her name was Helen Joy, was her actual first name. So he calls her H in the book. He changes his writing style so people can't recognize it's him. And then he publishes it under a different name. And in fact, he did such a good job disguising himself that a few of his friends found this book, read it, and then recommended it to C.S. Lewis because they thought it might help him work through his grief. But he writes again about this confusion in the face of death. He says, it's not true that I'm always thinking of age. But the times when I'm not are perhaps my worst. For then, though I have forgotten the reason, there is spread over everything a vague sense of wrongness. He's like, I'll see the berries on the bushes are reddening, and I'll think, why is that so depressing? I'll hear the clock chime, and I'll think, I don't remember that chime being so sad before. And then he'll say, oh yeah, that's why. And he'll remember, and it'll come back to his mind. He says, thought after thought, feeling after feeling, action after action had H for their object. Something will happen, and you'll think about, I want to tell my wife about this. You'll do something, this is what we do together. And then you'll realize she's not there anymore. Now their target is gone, he says. So many roads led thought to H, and I set out on one of them, but now there's an impassable frontiers post across it. So many roads once, now so many cul-de-sac. It's like the bridge is out to get to that person, to interact with that person. Martha says, not just if only, but I also see her saying this. She says, if only you had been here. And the other question that comes up a lot in the face of death is, Lord, where were you? Where was God? Where was God when she died? Where was God when they found the cancer? Where was God after the car accident? God, where were you when I called out to you and there was still time and you did nothing? Where were you, Jesus? I sent a messenger. He comes back alone with a message that is obviously false. Where were you, God? How many of us called out to God in that moment? Maybe we'd never even prayed before. And we thought, I'll give it a shot because what else do I have? And he didn't come through. And you thought, I'm done with you. C.S. Lewis, again, in his biography, is pretty vulnerable about his thoughts toward God. In fact, in his personal letters, a friend of him writes to him and says, can I get a copy of your book? And he says, okay, here it is, but I'm pretty honest in this book. It ends in a good place. But the road to get there is kind of bumpy. Here's what he says about his thoughts toward God. He says, meanwhile, where's God? When you're happy, so happy you have no sense of needing him, you'll be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face. And then you hear the lock and another lock on the inside. After that, silence. He says, is anybody home? It seemed like there was at one point, but now we're slamming on the door. And it's like an empty vacant house. God is not answering. You might as well turn away, he says. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? He says, not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. He says, my danger is coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there's no God after all, but, so this is what God's really like. Deceive yourself no longer. It was interesting that one thing I observed in the face of that time in my life where a lot of people were dying. You know, the one guy who drowned, most of the people who were close to him were not walking with God a year later. I remember talking to one of his roommates and he was like, I had a really consistent habit of prayer journaling, talking to God. And then after he died, a few days later, I wrote some facts down so I wouldn't forget him. And then I journaled again a couple of weeks later and then nothing for months. Didn't realize till later there was something there between him and God. He hadn't processed. I saw the same thing in my own journals at the time. It can be a time of real danger for our faith. And Jesus knows this, and this is why he's given us this story. Martha says, if only you'd been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. And so you can see the wrestling. On the one hand, this, but on the other hand, this. Does she think he's gonna raise Lazarus from the dead? And Jesus tells her, your brother will rise again. That's an ambiguous statement. does he mean to refer to the common Jewish belief that at the end of the age, the dead will rise who've placed their faith in God? Does he mean that? Or does he mean your brother will rise again in about 20 minutes? Yes, Martha said, he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She takes him as referring to the resurrection at the end of the age, and he keys in on her statement, the resurrection. He says, the resurrection, Martha, the resurrection? I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying, and everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never, ever die. Here's our I am statement. I am the resurrection and life. You know, it's one thing to express general belief in a resurrection. It's quite another thing to believe you're talking to the resurrection. You know, up until now, resurrection was an event. Jesus is now assigning resurrection to a person. Resurrection was an event that happened to you. Now resurrection is a person that happens to you. I am the resurrection and the life. Let's unpack this. We really have two I am statements in one, right? First of all, I am the resurrection. He says, anyone who believes in me will live even after dying. That's what he means by that. And so we see here the repeated emphasis on belief, trust. Religion says, anyone who's worked really hard and been good enough and their good deeds outweigh their bad. That's not what Jesus says. He says, whoever trusts in me, place your trust in Jesus and you can know that you will live even after dying. Death holds no power if you've placed your trust in Jesus. And I wanna tell you guys, I wanna predict the future right now. Someday, some of you will hear this statement right here. Scott Risley is dead. That's me. I bet you some of you here in this room will hear that statement someday. Scott Risley is dead. And I wanna tell you right now, don't you believe a word of it. Because at that moment, I will be more alive than I have ever been. And I will be far more alive than any of you all. Though separated from the body for a short time, I know that I will get a new body someday because I've put my trust in Jesus. And Jesus says to be absent from the body is to be at home with the Lord. And that's better by far. Do you want to have that kind of confidence in the face of death? Put your trust in Jesus. He also says, I'm the life. And for that, he says, everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never, ever die. So again, we see the belief. And again, we see just like last week, Jesus said, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. Predicts both eternal life as well as quality of life here and now. This eternal life, if you put your trust in Jesus, you can begin to experience that life now. And that life is so powerful that the grave will have no power over you. And that you can say with Paul, I'd rather depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. We can possess endless life now. You know, Jesus said about Lazarus, this sickness will not end in death. And he was right. But you could say for any Christian, this sickness will not end in death. You could say this cancer will not end in death. You could say this death will not end in death. You know why? Because Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And whoever believes in him will live after dying, and whoever lives in him and believes in him will never, ever die. You know, Lazarus is dead for a couple of days, and they're like, I guess he's dead. And Jesus is like, not so fast. You're jumping to conclusions here. And don't we do the same thing? You know, we've got somebody, and they've been dead for 20 or 30 years, and we're like, I guess they're dead. Jesus says, no, this sickness will not end in death. This death will not end in death. One day he's gonna empty all of the graves and give people new bodies and they'll live forever on a new heaven, in the new heavens and the new earth. And then he asks a very important question. Do you believe this, Martha? And he's asking each one of you that question here. Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Where is your trust when it comes to your eternal life? Where is your trust when it comes to the grave? Do you believe this? And Martha says, yes, I have always believed you're the Messiah, the Son of God, and the one who has come into the world from God. Those are three pretty profound statements about Jesus. And then she returned to Mary, and she called Mary aside from the mourners and told her, Mary, the teacher's here, and he's calling for you. And I gotta say, that statement there, that's actually true tonight. Jesus is here, and he's calling to you. He wants to talk to you about what you're facing, maybe about what you're facing, the struggles in your life, maybe about death. The teacher's here and is calling for you. Will you answer his call? Mary immediately went to him. And Jesus stayed outside the village at the place where Martha met him. And when the people who were at her house consoling Mary saw her leave so hastily, they assumed she was going to Lazarus's grave to weep, so they followed her there. So there's a whole crowd now coming with Mary. This is not a private interaction. And when Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet. What I love about this story is you see two sisters, each of whom dealing with grief in completely different ways. And you will see this. When you face grief, different people process grief in different ways. And don't go judging other people because they don't grieve like you. It doesn't mean they're not sad. It just means they handle it differently. You know, Martha, she's holding it together. She's having a theological conversation with Jesus. He meets her where she's at. You gotta go in. You gotta see where the person's at if you're really gonna be helpful to them. You gotta meet them where they're at. Don't jump in with 17 Bible verses and 4 Hallmark cards and, you know, just, you know what Jesus does. Just go be with them and see where they're at, see what they need. So Mary, you know, some of us are like Martha. I'm more like Martha. I can function through. Some of us are more like Mary. We're just a puddle of tears on the ground. She fell at his feet, which is where we always see Mary when we meet her. She's at the feet of Christ. And she said, Lord, if only you'd been here, my brother would not have died. The same thing that Martha says, but not followed by any theology. She's just crying. And Jesus doesn't defend himself. God won't defend himself. Surprisingly silent in the face of death. But Jesus saw her weeping. And he saw the other people wailing with her. And it says a deep anger welled up within him and he was deeply troubled. How interesting. Is that what you expected from Jesus? A lot of earlier translations don't even translate the verb correctly, a deep anger, but that's the word. It means to be outraged, to be furious. It's used in the literature to describe the snorting of angry horses. Getting ready for battle, stamping their feet. Anger. Is he mad at their unbelief? I don't think so. No, why is he angry? We wonder how God feels about death. And God says, look at my son. He says, you think you're mad about death? I saw this whole thing before humans ever died. I know the way things were supposed to be. I have seen millennia, an endless procession of broken hearts. Humans made in the image of God who were never meant to die being placed in the ground and their bodies turning into grotesque images of what they once were. He says, you think you're mad about death? I'm furious. So angry that I'm doing something about it. I'm going to pay the ultimate price by sending my one and only son to die on the cross for you. That's how angry I am about death. Jesus saw death and he was so mad. He was so mad. Where have you put him? He asked them. Where is he? They told him, Lord, come and see. Come and see. And then the Bible says something that, again, I'm not sure we would have expected. Then Jesus wept. The shortest verse in the Bible. He's not wailing like the mourners. It's a different word, first of all. Theirs was the loud wailing. This is the only time this word is used in our Bibles. It's a silent weeping. Jesus, the tears just silently rolling down his cheeks. It's also a different reason than the mourners. The people there are mourning because they don't think they're ever gonna see Lazarus again in this life. Jesus knows this guy's getting up in about 10 minutes. So why is he weeping? Is this disingenuous? One thing we see here from Jesus is a tremendous empathy. He's entering into the emotions of others. But he's also weeping for the same reason that he's outraged. Because he's seen the table with the empty chair where that person used to be. He sees the bed that once had two and now it only has one in it. He sees death. He sees people torn apart from one another. He sees the broken hearts. He sees down through the millennia. He sees the future people, the future millions and billions that would go through the same thing. He sees right down here to this very night where some of you are facing death and the tears still flow. And Jesus says, you do not weep alone. You do not weep alone. We wonder how God feels about death. And we go to him in our anger and we go to him in our rage and we're blind with tears and we're pounding on the door and we're wondering when he's gonna answer and we're wondering what God is gonna say. And God says, look at my son. I'm angrier and sadder, more heartbroken about death than you could ever be. And the God of the universe comes down and sits down beside us and puts his arm around us and we weep together. C.S. Lewis says in his book, later, he refers to his analogy of pounding on the door and God is not answering. But he says, you reach a point in the grief where your heart begins to quiet down and you see God actually was answering. And you begin to hear that still small voice of God. And what you realize is I was so angry and pounding so hard that I couldn't hear, I couldn't see. And now he says, come and see my son. He's the God who understands and feels your sorrow and your anger. And the Jews were saying, see how he loved him. But some of them said, couldn't this man who opened the eyes of the blind have kept this man also from dying? Yeah, they only had enough faith for a healing. They didn't have faith for a resurrection. Notice too, the two perspectives on Jesus. One is seeing his love and they don't quite understand the tragedy, but they're focused on the love of God. Others are focused on the tragedy and they're like, I don't know about the love. All I know is this bad thing happened. And that's really your two options when bad things happen in your life. You can reinterpret the tragedy in light of God's love, or you can deny God's love in light of this tragedy. Don't trade what you know about God for what you don't know. Jesus was still angry as he arrived at the tomb, a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. Roll the stone aside, Jesus told them. But Martha, the dead man's sister, protested. Lord, he's been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible. Or as the KJV says, he stinketh. Remember that description of the rotting corpse? One of the real distinguishing features is the smell. She's like, I got like a potluck going here. We got green bean casserole, Lord. Nobody's gonna be hungry if you open that tomb. Martha, remember that message I sent? Didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you would trust me, believe? So they rolled the stone aside. And then Jesus looked up to heaven and said, Father, I thank you for hearing me. You always hear me, but I said it out loud for the sake of all these people standing here so they will believe that you sent me. And then Jesus shouted, Lazarus, come out. And the dead man came out. Why did he shout? Not so Lazarus could hear him. His ears didn't work. He was dead. Not so the father could hear him. He said, I thank you. I know you always hear me. So the people could hear. And he calls Lazarus out of the tomb. And the dead man came out. It's a good thing, we shouldn't be surprised that Jesus is doing this. He said in John 5, the time is coming when all the dead in their graves will hear the voice of God's Son and they will rise again. Honestly, it's a good thing he said Lazarus. Otherwise, he might have emptied all the graves this side of the River Jordan. Do you understand what happened when he said, Lazarus, come out? The liquid brain materializes. It's a brain again. The heart that has dissolved reforms and begins pumping blood through these 60,000 miles of capillaries and arteries and veins, which suddenly reform and reinflate, pressurized. The eyes become pressurized. 500,000 miles of neural pathways reform in an instant. The breathing begins. All the toxins in the body are pushed down to where they belong, safely there to digest food. And then he stands up and begins walking. His hands and feet were bound in grave clothes. His head was wrapped in a head cloth. And Jesus says, unwrap him and let him go. Unwrap him and let him go. The raising of Lazarus, what does it mean? Let's draw a couple of points of application by way of conclusion. First of all, it confirms Christ's claim, I am the resurrection. It's the pattern in John, right? Jesus makes an I am statement, then he does a miracle to expound the I am statement. And so by raising Lazarus, he's showing I can raise corpses back to life. It also anticipates the greater resurrection, one that would happen just a few weeks later, the resurrection of the Son of God. And in that resurrection, no one would need to roll the stone away because the angels were gonna take care of that. In that resurrection, no one needs to tell him to come out of the tomb. God the Father is gonna do that. No one needs to take the grave clothes off of him because they will be neatly folded there, right there, lying in the tomb for the disciples and the women to discover. This is the greater resurrection, the resurrection of the Son of God to a resurrection body, not like Lazarus called back to a body that will die again, not like Lazarus called down to live life in a fallen world. This is the resurrection of the Son of God to receive a resurrection body who will never die again, who will ascend into heaven, and who will form an entire community, and who will one day call all of the dead out of their graves. And there will never be any dying again. Because he says, behold, I've made all things new. That's the greater resurrection. The resurrection of Christ, which confirms our resurrection, which ultimately allows us to face death with hope. With hope. That was one of the things that really stuck out in these memoirs. To read the memoirs of a non-Christian grappling with death, which I said, like I said, was very helpful, but it also was sad. Because she's coming from a particular worldview that believes something specific about death. And Didion writes near the end of her book this. I realize as I write this, I do not want to finish this account. Nor did I want to finish the year. The craziness is receding, but no clarity is taking its place. I look for resolution and find none. I did not want to finish the year because I know that as the days pass, as January becomes February and February becomes summer, certain things will happen. My image of John at the instant of his death will become less immediate, less raw. It will become something that happened in another year. My sense of John himself, John alive, will become more remote, even mudgy, softened. In fact, this is already beginning to happen. All year, I've been keeping time by last year's calendar, what we were doing on this day last year, where did we have dinner? And I realized today for the first time that my memory of this day a year ago is a memory that does not involve John. This day a year ago was December 31st, 2003. And John did not see this day a year ago. John was dead. And then she concludes like this. She says, I know why we try to keep the dead alive. We try to keep them alive in order to keep them with us. I also know that if we're to live ourselves, there comes a point at which we must relinquish the dead Let them go. Keep them dead. Let them become the photograph on the table. We keep the dead alive in our memories, and there comes a point where we have to let them go and let them become a photograph. I'll tell you what, the Christians I know who have died are a lot more than a photograph on a table. They're real. They live, and I will see them again. C.S. Lewis ends his memoir on a much more hopeful note. The final paragraph, he says this: how wicked it would be if we could to call the dead back. He says, poor Lazarus. We feel sorry for different people in scripture. He's like, I feel most sorry for him. Here he is. He's in heaven for 4 days, hanging out with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the prophet Isaiah and Elijah. He's seeing the throne room of God, the sea of glass, the gemstones. And then somebody comes up and taps him on the shoulder. Hey, Lazarus, we're gonna have to send you back. We don't normally do this, but the Son of God is calling for you. He goes back. Who better than Lazarus could understand the sacrifice, though, that Jesus made to enter the world for you and me to die on the cross? And then he says this. He recounts the final moments of his wife's life. She said, I am at peace with God. Do you want to die knowing that you're at peace with God? And then he says something kind of strange. She smiled, but not at me. And then she turned back to the eternal fountain. Lewis was a classic literature buff. This is a line from Dante's Paradise. In Dante's Paradise, Dante is being given a tour of heaven by this woman. She's leading him up further and further, further and further, closer and closer to the throne room of God. And when he gets close enough to where God is, he says, I lost my tour guide. She wasn't focused on me anymore. She turned back to the eternal fountain. And he says, that's what it was like when my wife died. She loved me, and I loved her. But she had stepped into the presence of one far greater than I. And she smiled, but she wasn't smiling at me anymore. She turned to the eternal fountain. Paul writes, we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. Do you want to have hope in the face of death? You know, Paul doesn't say we don't grieve. He says, so you will not grieve like those who have no hope. We have a hopeful grieving, a joyful grieving, a grieving that says, on the one hand, I'm separated from this person, but on the other hand, I know that soon I will see them, that this life is so short compared to eternity. God can give you hope in the face of death, hope of a resurrection one day, hope of reunion, hope that, as C.S. Lewis writes at the end of his Narnia series, he says, this life was just the title page and the cover page of a story that goes on forever and whose adventures have been unparalleled in this life. That's the kind of hope that we look forward to. Thanks, Lord, for the hope you offer in the face of death. Thanks for how you demonstrated your power here with Lazarus, Lord. I pray that this would bring tremendous hope, Lord, to those of us that are struggling with this subject of death, that are facing this in our own lives or in the lives of someone we care about, Lord. I pray that we would turn to you in that hour. And I pray that we would learn how to receive comfort and support from you in the face of that and all the other hard things we'll go through in life. And I pray we'd come out on the other side with our faith even stronger, Lord, as we see you capable of doing something that we never thought you could do. Amen.